In Rwanda itself, 14 years on from the genocide, 60,000 people still languish in jail, many of them still not charged with any offence. Karina Tetsakian, a human rights worker, spent several months talking to some of them, and their accounts appear in a book published this week. Karina told me first about their conditions.
They're really quite inhuman, I would say. The extent of the overcrowding is quite unbelievable. So to give you an illustration of that, the standard living space of a prisoner is 40 centimetres wide.
Which isn't very much, is it?
It's about the width of a small human body.
Yes.
And there are no cells, so people are sleeping on wooden planks in sort of bunk-like structures. Each person has his 40 centimetres and the next person will be next to him with no partitions or anything in between.
And what about food?
Food is a problem. There are even still now shortages of food, periodic shortages of food.
And do they get visits from their families at all?
They do get visits, but the conditions of visits are really quite shocking. Visits last literally 3 minutes. So how it works is that the families queue up at the prison gate, and then the prisoners are brought out in groups of around 50 at a time. They line up, the guard blows the whistle, and the families literally lunge forward. And they're in one row, and the prisoners are in a row opposite them.
And we shouldn't forget that these people are in there, most of them, for genocide.
That's correct. The majority are accused of genocide, but many of them actually have not been tried and haven't even been anywhere near a court. So what happened in the early days after the genocide is that thousands of people were rounded up, many of them arbitrarily, and then were stuck in prison for more than 10 years. So there are people in there who don't even have a case file, who've never been questioned.
So we don't basically have a clue whether they're guilty or not.
That's right. There are for sure people in there who are guilty of the most terrible crimes, but also a lot of people who are innocent.
You met a lot of the prisoners when you were there doing your research for the book. What sort of things did they tell you?
Well, they told us about their experience of imprisonment from the very beginning. So the ones who had been arrested in 94, 95 described how the first day they arrived in the prison, they just couldn't believe what they saw with this mass of human beings, and many of them didn't think they would ever survive. But I would say it wasn't all quite as grim and harrowing as you might imagine, because people find ways of surviving. And so they described to us also the different activities that go on inside the prisons. Education, music. There are many teachers amongst the prisoners. So there's a whole range of different subjects that are being taught inside.
You met one man, didn't you, who was in fact aged 59, but he looked, you said, as though he was in his 70s. Now tell me a little bit about him.
Well, he was a man in Gitarama prison who was arrested just a few months after the end of the genocide. And he had been in prison for 10 years by the time I met him. And during that entire time, he had never received a single visit from anybody. His entire family had been killed. He was just there. He was a very poor man. And if you're a prisoner without any money, you really fall to the bottom of the pile.
Well, let's hear what that man told you.
In the Kashore, the conditions were terrible. I was tortured. My finger was injured by a soldier who hit me with a bayonet. He was trying to force me to confess. He wanted to cut my fingers. They tortured and beat me almost every day and night. We were about 260 detainees in one cell. We couldn't lie down. We could only sit. We couldn't get outside. We went to the toilet inside the cell and emptied it into the ditch the next morning. Washing was officially forbidden, as was drinking water. Those who had families received food. I had no family. I survived thanks to other detainees who shared their food with me. A soldier questioned us. He tried to make us give him names of people we had killed. That was his form of investigation. Some detainees admitted killing. Others, like me, said we hadn't killed anyone. They accused me of killing a specific person. The soldiers said they would go and see the house of that person, and that if one single tile was missing from the roof, I would be kept in prison. I was transferred to Gitarama prison on 12 February 1995. It was terrible. People were dying every day, every day. You can't imagine what it was like. Many were killed by other prisoners. They were trampled on. The soldiers pushed the people inside. There was a slope that led towards a cellar. People were falling in without knowing there was a ditch. People didn't care about human lives. Every morning, the soldiers used to ask the Capitan General how many of us had died. At the beginning, I slept outside near a prisoner who became my friend. We used to pray together. In the morning, I stayed sitting between his legs as there was no other space. The military came and beat me. My friend said, "Why are you beating this poor man who has no family? Let him die naturally." He lent me his shorts, as on the first day they took all my clothes. Those who have a position of responsibility in that prison get meals. The rest of us don't eat properly. We get a few grains of corn and peas. I've not had any visits at all since I've been here, so I don't receive any food from outside. Sometimes a prisoner gives me some scraps to share, for example, sweet potato or cassava. Friends inside get together to buy me clothes and shoes. I have another friend who is also old like me. He and the man who had helped me at the beginning are my only two friends. I'm not tempted to confess. If I had something to confess, I would have done so earlier on. But I have nothing to confess. Even if I'm not released, I want to be tried. At least, otherwise I will spend 10 years like this. I'm sure God is seeing me suffer and that the day of my release will come. Even though I'm old, I would prefer to die outside and be buried in dignity instead of being thrown out like a dog. No one is living in my house. It has probably crumbled. I have no other relatives here, as my family is from Kikongoro, and they were all killed too. RPF soldiers razed the area, and they killed everybody there in 1996 or 1997. Yes, prison has become a bit like home. I feel relieving talking to you. It helps me forget. I'm crying even though I'm old. I don't know if my pain will ever go away.
Well, that was one of the prisoners that Karina spoke to. What sort of effect did it have on you going into the prisons?
Well, it was, I would say, quite an intense experience in the sense that not only did I spend several months doing this work, but I spent quite a long time talking to each prisoner. So on average, each interview lasted between 2 and 3 hours. So of course, during that time, you really get drawn into someone's life. But then underlying all these interviews, there was, of course, always the thought that many of these people had probably committed some terrible crimes during the genocide. Now, I was not there to question them about that, and I didn't ask them what they had done or not done during the genocide. But you spend a long time talking to people. Many of them are quite charming, quite interesting people, and you go away wondering, really, out of all those people, who is guilty, who is innocent? And the absence of justice, of course, makes it very difficult to differentiate between the guilty and the innocent.
Well, indeed, is there any chance that people like the man whose words we heard will get a trial?
Well, what has been happening more recently is that the government has been proceeding with trials under what they call the Gacaca system, which is a system loosely based on the traditional model of community participation, originally used to resolve fairly minor local disputes, but now being used to try the most serious criminal offences. So through that system, people are coming up for trial more quickly, but it's also a system that has been very flawed and that is vulnerable to corruption, political pressures, conflicts of interest. So people like him may well come up now for trial before that system. There's no guarantee, of course, that they will get a fair trial. And the numbers are still so huge. I mean, there are still tens of thousands of people in that position.
Karina Tetsakian and her book's called Le Chateau, The Lives of Prisoners in Rwanda. The words of the prisoner we heard were taken from her book and read by a BBC colleague.